Well, vicarious trauma is the form of trauma that we experience when we're just dealing with people who have experienced trauma and are dealing with high levels of stress. And even if our lives are perfect in any way, shape, or form, the fact that we choose or are working with people who experience any form of trauma, and remember, trauma comes in very different forms, in very different packages, and looks very different, but there, we know enough about trauma to be able to define trauma really well. So when you've experienced, when you've worked with someone who's experienced trauma, you can't help but have that impact you on some level. The more closely you work with people who've experienced trauma, the more closely you relate to that trauma, and you can empathize around that trauma, and it's almost like you take on a little piece of it, even though you don't, but it impacts you, and it starts to drain you. And one of my favorite interchangeable words that I like to use with vicarious trauma is compassion fatigue. And it's really about the, you know, trauma that results from wanting to help a suffering or traumatized person. And my definition, and I created this in the late 90s, was the weariness that comes from caring. It's like when we care so much that we grow weary, that's what vicarious trauma is. That's what compassion fatigue is. And the cool thing for me is compassion fatigue is not something we like to feel, but when you're fatigued, what do? You need to rest. You need to replenish. You need to rejuvenate. And so for me, even though the word sounds a little strange, fatigue, to me it has a lot of hope because we can unfatigue ourselves. We can re-energize ourselves, but we have to be intentional in doing that. And we have to make the time to do it. And it's not about going on a two-week vacation to Hawaii, although that's wonderful, terrific when you can do it, or take any kind of break that you can take. Sometimes it's taking 10 seconds to breathe or have quiet time, or do something that makes your life a teeny bit easier, like pack a little lunch so you have something to eat throughout the day. And again, self-care comes in so many different forms, but it can take as little as a few seconds to days. But we all need to still be aware of that and realize, you know, practicing self-care is critically important. And self-care needs to be practiced in multiple areas, not just in one area. I can take my care of myself well physically, but I might not be doing a good job with emotionally or psychologically or my relationships and socially or financially or occupationally or spiritually. And in our book, when you know, that is, again, downloadable and free on the pages in Chapter 2, there's a really nice two-page worksheet that defines the areas of self-care or gives you definitions of self-care and then gives some examples of strategies. And oftentimes people know these things. It's just being reminded and being encouraged to do it and to put it into practice, because we know it, but we don't always do it.
Yes, and I have to say, because my poor dog-eared copy of this thing, I'm lying because I never did print it out. It's on my computer. But if it was
smart
in paper, it would be falling apart by now. there's the professional quality of life scale that Dr. Johnson has put in here, and a self-care checklist. So as I was saying, you know, you need to start by scanning yourself. You don't have to make that up. You can go to page 46 and 48 of this book and find out where you are. But I have to ask, so one of the things that teachers, again, terrible, we're all terrible at taking care of ourselves because we take care of others, is, well, I don't have, you know, vicarious trauma because, and I say this with all due respect for the teachers who were and are working in Columbine, who were and are working in Sandy Hook Elementary School, who were and are working in any place where a colleague dies or a student harms themselves. Mm-hmm. Or, so, you know, that is definitely a trauma, but you don't have to have that have had happened in your school for your staff to become fatigued and to look carefully at how they're taking care of themselves.
No, and this is where the adverse childhood experiences kind of fit in. If you live with a child who is, if you work with a child who is experiencing alcohol or an addiction or domestic violence in their home, if you live with students who are homeless or in foster care, or dealing with incarceration. If you live with students who are have a family member with a chronic, or not live, I mean work, with a student who has a family member with chronic illness, I mean, this is where there's a crossover to the adverse childhood experiences and also intergenerational trauma and other forms of community and cultural violence that occur. So, you know, trauma doesn't always come in the form of something like a shooting or a stabbing or a death. Trauma comes in many, many forms, and I think the best definitions of trauma that I've seen, which I actually used in my own dissertation when I wrote it, were from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And SAMHSA has a great list of the definitions of trauma and the types of trauma. In fact, it's one of the most comprehensive lists that I've ever seen. And it's really eye-opening, and sometimes in the process of teaching, I start the lecture or start the teaching with these forms of trauma in mind, because it's easy to think, oh, that doesn't impact me, right? But it does.
Right.
And it, more often than not, I've yet to meet an educator, there's probably one out there, but I've yet to meet one who hasn't experienced some form of, you know, of working with a student who has these forms of trauma.
So, and I have to say, on behalf of the Attachment and Trauma Network, we were originally a support group for adoptive parents. And well, that's another trauma that is often overlooked, although I am familiar with SAMHSA's list and adoption is on there. You know, keep in mind that you could have parents raising children who were adopted, as I have, who have, you know, orphanage trauma or
right.
attachment trauma as a result. So don't forget that even though the child might be in a household that is highly functional and stable, that the child could have prenatal or early childhood trauma like my son did from the orphanage that you wouldn't see from my house because that's not where it came from.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad you brought up the point. And I think the other thing to remember is there are outward forms of trauma that we see, and then we have emotional abuse and psychological maltreatment, which, again, are not really visible but are real things that people experience and kids experience. We have man-made disasters and natural disasters. You know, anyone who's been have experienced forced displacement. There's a lot of different forms of trauma. And I know we're not here to talk about that, but I think sometimes it behooves us to step back when we're so immersed in doing trauma-informed work to remind people and go back to the basics of teaching people about what is trauma. And again, we continue to learn more and more about what that is, and the spectrum of what we call trauma now is so much more broad than it used to be, and my hope is it continues to broaden even further.